don't frighten us by telling us the facts, the facts, the facts, the facts, the facts, the facts.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 13th, 2019, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Sarah joined me to talk about the longest federal government shutdown in history, its effects, and media coverage of it. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line again this week from Idaho, first we have Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
And again as well, also in Idaho, Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Rachel and Bill. I'm glad to be back.
All right. Well, unsurprisingly, we're going to be talking about the federal government shutdown, which continues. It's now the longest shutdown of the government in U.S. history. Rachel, I think, prepared a lot of the research for this week's topic. Rachel, where do we start on this?
So like you said, it's the longest shutdown ever, exceeding the shutdown during the Bill Clinton years. I believe that was 95 and 96, correct? It seems to be a real mess. The new House Democrats are trying to drum up support for a bill, but, Republicans who control the Senate will not pass legislation, knowing Trump won't sign it. And they're kind of, they feel sheltered from the blame thanks to the president just being very loud and very out there tweeting about how it's the Democrats' fault and blah, blah, blah. So Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has kind of maintained a silence, but more and more senators and congresspeople are calling him out for not advancing any bills. Some moderate Republicans are starting to waver, it seems like, but just Trump is just totally blocking everything. And as long as he's like just stonewalling everyone, the pressure is rising from the shutdown. And also news is coming out more and more about the Russia inquiry and how the White House has been blocking that investigation. And and the House committees are preparing to investigate his actions. So it's just a lot of blame is coming on the president from a lot of fronts. And meanwhile, this shutdown has cost the U.S. economy $3.6 billion, according to S&P Global Ratings, a toll that will exceed Trump's funding demand in 2 weeks' time. So it's not looking very good. Trump has said back in December that he was happy to kind of take the blame for all this, and he was trying to show his art of the deal, but it seems to be backfiring pretty spectacularly.
What do we think about the coverage of the shutdown, just to go a little meta on this for a bit?
It seems like people are focusing on specific agencies and groups that don't really make the most sense to focus on. Coverage is focusing a lot on prison guards and federal prisons not getting paid. And while prisoners were enjoying steak and Cornish game hens for their holiday meals. Vox did an article kind of showing like how ludicrous this framing is. And there was a quote from Chris Kemet, the senior counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The framing of these articles is so irresponsible and misleading. One of the many ways that incarcerated people suffer is that they are subjected to bad, unhealthy prison food. They do not, quote, eat like a boss. And the Vox article went on to say, treating prisoners humanely, including an occasional treat at the holidays, isn't just the right thing to do, but it can be smart policy, too. In other countries, the more compassionate approach is credited for reducing the risk of someone reoffending once he's released from prison. And it also pointed out that nearly half of federal prison inmates are convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. The framing has just been kind of weird, focusing on the carceral state, and I'm not entirely sure why we're upholding prison guards as poor, poor victims in this federal shutdown.
Were people assuming that the government shutdown meant that no one had made any provision for feeding federal inmates during that time? Like, that's a very strange thing to have assumed.
Exactly. Like, these meals are traditional, and I'm sure they're part of the food budget. So it's not like, oh, we are stealing money from personnel's paychecks to feed prisoners steaks. Like, it's a really, really insane leap of logic to go to that. I think the Washington Post did an article framing it that way. I think the New York Times did as well. It was just really sloppy journalism, I feel.
Somebody, presumably the prison guard unions or whatever, must be feeding these articles, like, to public relations. So anyway, mm-hmm. I don't know. Sarah, any thoughts on that?
I just wanted to go back a little bit and mention a little bit bare bones facts. So Democrats have been trying to open different departments individually, but Republicans have straight up said that removes any bargaining leverage we have to get this wall passed. We don't want to make people too comfortable because then there's no negotiation to be made. Basically, the Democrats would have won. So, a lot of this is going at this, like winners and losers. And clearly you can make an argument for that rhetorical use of winning and losing. But the fact is that there are federal workers and federal contractors that aren't getting money and that aren't getting their regular paychecks, and then they're going to be put in financial straits. And it's just a simple bargaining chip for politicians. And it seems really cruel and callous to frame it that way. Clearly, this is a lot of posturing, and I don't think that the American people are super on board with this framing of it. I think they are seeing the reality of it, I hope. I haven't seen any polls on this, but I just don't think it's that convincing to people to be all blustering. I hope it's not working on people.
Well, Sarah, what do you think, though, on that point about the piecemeal strategy of trying to reopen the government piece by piece, which we've been hearing more and more about as a potential strategy? The Republicans arguing that they would lose leverage if that happened. My concern, I don't know what you think, is that if the Democrats do manage to reopen certain pieces of the government, that they might lose leverage because certain departments might just, get shut indefinitely.
Oh, that's an interesting point that I haven't really put a lot of thought into. And it's interesting that I don't think that's been brought up at all on the news, because the PBS NewsHour does mention these things in brief, in their news brief, which is the Democrats' position on opening piecemeal. But they haven't really raised that scenario. So that's an interesting thought. And you can see how once they lose everything, that all the pressure, outside pressure on Democrats, you could see them folding on and making further concessions. That is, we have seen precedent and a pattern of that happening. So that's an interesting point.
Because, I mean, the conservatives, the more really hardline ones, especially outside of Congress and so forth and outside of the administration, have been really jumping up and down and being like, well, look at how, you know, the world hasn't fallen apart with all these non-essential workers not being at work. And so this proves that we don't need any of them, which, of course, is ludicrously stupid because they're, you know, there's people you can get by without, you know, working every day of the year, but you do need them to be doing work at some point. And, you know, as opposed to people that you can't run anything without them being there every day. But like, I think that the risk here is that if you do open things piecemeal, you're going to end up with a bunch of agencies and departments that maybe don't get as much attention that are still important and we do need them to be doing the work. But, you know, things will sort of totter along for a while without them, and the conservative impulse will just be like, well, let's just not give in on this either and just never open it because they didn't give us our wall.
I did see a Reason.com article that unsurprisingly was kind of rubbing their hands together with glee, kind of pointing that out, like, oh, well, at first they were talking about TSA agents and talking about security theater, which I was like, yes, I'm on board with that. But then they were like, oh, ho, ho, I guess we don't need this many IRS workers, do we? And then I was like, no, abort, abort. So I think, I think people are kind of formulating those arguments, and that could turn out somewhat disastrously if that kind of non-essential, quote unquote, term is applied to many essential programs that maybe just don't have to run every day, but they are essential to the functioning of our government.
Well, Rachel, let's talk about TSA and IRS in some more depth here. You wanted to talk about some of those. What do we need to know there?
So another kind of unequal framing has been TSA workers, kind of pointing out the plight of them, whereas a lot less ink has been spilled over like kind of the behind the scenes stuff. So FAA have been kind of trying to highlight potential risk to air safety. Air traffic controllers, some have been furloughed, some have been forced to work. And obviously morale is low if you're forced to work without pay with a skeleton crew. And also a lot of those routine inspections aren't happening. So they say that they were up to date on their inspections, but the national president of the Professional Aviation Safety Specialists said in a New York Times article, every day that goes by that the government is shut down, safety is going to be compromised. Every day that goes by, something could occur that causes a crack in the system. So the FAA union is definitely trying to highlight how people that you don't see that do these routine inspections are super important. And I would argue, TSA is
doesn't do anything.
Yes, exactly. They don't do anything. It's been proven time and time again. They don't screen that well. They don't actually stop people from traveling with contraband. There's been many articles about how people have been able to sneak knives and other weapons past TSA agents, and how it is all just security theater that's meant to pacify people but doesn't actually accomplish anything. Whereas safety inspections definitely do accomplish things. And I think this is hopefully a good way to highlight that workers who do inspections and those agencies have been kind of running on less funding over the years, and how they've been trying to manage with less and less resources, and how this is kind of a tipping point where they have no resources and thus can't do their jobs and protect the people like they are meant to do.
Well, food inspections in particular, I know you wanted to highlight, because that's an area that's been underfunded relative to its needs even before the shutdown.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of like Facebook punditry saying like, oh, ho, ho, the FDA didn't catch the romaine lettuce outbreak before it occurred. But I think that definitely ignores that they have been forced to run on a hobbled budget for decades, and how they haven't been able to inspect facilities on a schedule that would actually be helpful in catching these outbreaks before they occur. And I'm a member of APHL, the Association of Public Health Laboratories, and on a Facebook post, they pointed out, in addition to FDA surveillance being negatively impacted by the shutdown, state data provided to FDA may not be reviewed as quickly and acted upon. For example, state laboratories, that's where I come in, provide critical food and feed testing surveillance data that is reviewed by FDA and USDA and subsequently used in some cases to issue product import alerts and recalls. That means those alerts and recalls might be delayed, and those delays could cause people to get sick. When it comes to outbreak detection and action, every day counts. And the fact that information that labs are generating just can't get reviewed and action can't be taken based on that data that's generated, many people could be affected if contaminated food enters our food supply.
Now, for some reason, Internal Revenue Service workers were being press ganged back into service without pay as if they were air traffic controllers. What's going on there?
I found a good Guardian article that kind of did a bullet point breakdown of all these effects that are happening. And for the IRS, they said, fearing a true backlash, Trump gave a special and legally dubious order for the IRS to continue processing tax refunds, meaning IRS workers are among those required to report for work without pay. But the potential for delays or processing disasters grows as staff resources and morale are stretched. And I know I'm not getting a refund this year because I haven't for the past few years. And last year, I waited until the very last week to file my taxes, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one feeling that way. So I'm anticipating a lot of people waiting to pay their taxes or file for their returns if it means that they're getting delays in their tax return coming to them. So I can see this being a disaster, especially as April approaches, and if there's no end in sight. A lot of people are probably going to feel the same way. So I see that being very disastrous for the IRS in the next few months.
So what's going on with the national parks?
I found a New York Times article about Joshua Tree in particular. A lot of national parks are being closed. I think in Colorado, a lot of the roads just weren't getting plowed to the national parks, so state agencies decided to shut them down. But in California, a lot of them are staying open. And in Joshua Tree National Park, there's just no oversight. And so people were trying to camp off trail, find untouched places. And to get to those places, they were cutting down Joshua trees, which are obviously important to Joshua Tree National Park. They were cutting them down and clearing these makeshift roads so they could drive their cars through the desert and like go four wheeling and stuff. And a lot of people have pointed out that there's like overflowing garbage cans, like overflowing toilets with no amenities available. And a lot of volunteers have stepped up, but they just cannot keep up with the demand of like hundreds of visitors coming to these parks every day. So it's pretty dire out there, and the ecological effects could extend years and years. Well, probably hundreds of years, because a lot of these Joshua trees are extremely old and unique to this ecosystem. So it's just awful to see people destroying this beautiful habitat.
I saw quite a few responses to this on social media that troubled me a bit because they seemed to sort of despair in response to this news and suggest that this was somehow indicative of like the behavior of humanity as a whole or something, you know, that like, well, if this is what we do when there's no rules and whatever and nobody monitoring, then, you know, that shows that we can't be trusted on anything, and you know that it's all going down here, and we're headed for an ecological catastrophe, and et cetera. Which I guess maybe we are, but not for that reason. I think that this we have to be careful about sort of overinflating like the sense of who's doing this. I think it's a relatively small number of people. I think that national park in particular is in a bit of a unique situation because of its very immediate proximity to Los Angeles. And like, not going to throw Los Angeles under the bus here, but like, I would guess that a lot of these people are doing it for the gram. Like, they're going out there and cutting stuff down for their Instagrammable moments, or, you know, they're taking souvenirs or whatever. And I think that that is maybe a little bit different and probably a relatively narrow response by certain bad actors. I'm not downplaying what happened, but like, let's just be careful about sort of overinflating or, like suggesting a much bigger impact than maybe, or significance of this than there actually is. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Right. I agree. Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
Oh, well, I just want to say that I agree completely. I think it's just, easy to make, to apply this to the whole, but I don't think it is like that at all. I think that is a special case. And it might even be, you know, just hyper localized, because I think, you know, that kind of reaction horrifies so many people because it's so outside of our norms, whether, and not just up here, or, you know, if you think of like, oh, the politeness of the Midwest, you know, it's not a coastal thing. It's not a Midwest thing. Like, across the board, people are horrified by this. But I think you could maybe point to, like, this could be a sign of American individualism, like when people only think about themselves. I think there is something that you could say about that, but it's just to point to make this your sole argument, like piece of evidence to support that argument, is ludicrous. It's just not that relevant to the whole. I think people, you know, the fact that volunteers stepped up to try and help with cleanup vandalism and clear out garbage and stuff, that's more, I think, who we are, like, humanly speaking, you know. It's just, yeah.
And it seems like there's a tendency on social media to have a sort of fatalistic response to these things that suggests that whenever anything the government shuts down or whatever, that everyone goes full the purge. And I don't think that's actually an accurate reflection of what's happening. Rachel, you wanted to comment as well.
I've been reading about how collective spaces are treated. And I think a big part of that is a sense of ownership. And I don't think that Americans feel a collective sense of ownership for national parks, because it is kind of something that we don't trumpet a lot as having these public lands available to all Americans. So I think that might be a piece of it as well. And the fact that these volunteers are stepping up shows that they do feel that sense of ownership. And so that is encouraging, that some people do feel the sense of ownership and the sense of stewardship towards the land. And like you said, it's probably a small minority actually vandalizing and mistreating this land and these facilities.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean that, you know, the Interior Department has made a big push in recent years to say it's your land, it's your parks, it's your public, you know, whatever. But this is the same exact Interior Department that really what they say when they say that is it's your oil fields and we're going to tap them. Like, you know, that you know, it's not your lands in the sense of preservation. It's your lands in the sense of exploitation, which I think does dovetail right into the attitude that some people took in response to insufficient monitoring during the shutdown. Finally, let's talk about the impact on workers. I think, you know, there's a lot of precariousness for a lot of people, financial precarity, I guess, for a lot of these federal workers. I mean, for some reason, the conservatives all seem to think that they're living so high on the hog with these government jobs that none of them should have any sort of financial problems because, you know, they've clearly got so much money socked away. But I don't think that's really an accurate reflection of a lot of people's existence, especially because the federal government also has a lot of contractors and things who have even less sort of protection and also are compensated less.
Yes. According to that Guardian kind of bullet point breakdown article, affected households are mostly on the lower end of the middle class spectrum, with average take home pay of about $500 per employee, which definitely belies that misconception of of people living high on the hog. And the pinch is keenly felt by African Americans who fill the ranks of federal employees at proportions greater than their share of the overall population. And also, the New York Times showed a map of how many federal workers are actually in the various states. Obviously, D.C. had the greatest concentration at over 900 workers per 10,000 workers being federal employees. But something that surprised me was Idaho has 88 federal employees per 10,000 workers, and Montana has 157. Something that was kind of going around the Twitterverse was a video of Senator John Tester from Montana speaking out against his fellow senators in their inaction. And I kind of wondered why he was so vehement about it. But the fact that there is such a high proportion of federal employees in Montana maybe points to the fact that he's feeling the pressure from his constituency. And he pointed out that that Congress is a co-equal branch of government to the president. So the fact that we're letting one man stonewall and cause this utter breakdown in the federal government is kind of ridiculous, and just showing that the Congress and the legislative branch has a responsibility to act on to benefit the citizens, and all these federal employees need a voice in the government, and I applaud him for doing so. And I think the Senate in particular needs to feel a lot of pressure from their constituents and be pushed to act sooner rather than later.
Certainly an interesting approach from a relatively conservative or I'll say moderate senator in the Democratic caucus as compared to right-wing Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia, representing a similarly sort of conservative but with some populist tendencies state. Manchin, by contrast, endorsing Trump's threat to rule by decree and end the shutdown through executive orders and military orders regarding border security, which Manchin said something along the lines of, well, I don't think it's a great option, but it's probably his only option to get us out of this situation, and that he believed that the Senate would immediately respond to that by enacting something to end the shutdown. But again, explicitly endorsing a rule by decree model by this particular fascist president. I don't think that's necessarily something that we would like to have in the Democratic caucus, is someone like Manchin saying stuff like that. All right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for providing all of this information for us about the shutdown.
Thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure.
And Sarah, thanks for being on today.
Glad I could be here.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.